Please.
Case number 09-5162-NL, Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Association of Hunt versus Kenneth Lee Salazar in his official capacity as Secretary of the United States Department of Interior and Health. For the appellate and RMC, Mr. Wilmot for appellate TRTC, and Mr. Murphy for the appellate.
Morning, counsel.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Sharon Buccino, and I'm representing the appellant's Natural Resources Defense Council et al. I will take 10 minutes to address issues arising under the National Environmental Policy Act, including public participation, air quality and cumulative impacts analysis. Mr. Wilmoth, representing the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership, will take 5 minutes to address issues arising under the Federal Land Policy and Management Act and remaining NEPA issues. I would like to reserve 2 minutes of my 10 minutes for rebuttal. And this is a consolidation of two separate cases, the one that NRDC et al. Brought, as well as the separate case that TRCP brought. The Atlantic Rim Project covers 270,000 acres in south central Wyoming. While some drilling has occurred, large parts of the project area are still relatively untouched and provide valuable recreational opportunities for hunting, bird watching, and hiking. The job of balancing these uses against the nation's energy needs is a difficult one. But here, the Bureau of Land Management made several critical errors in this balancing act. And the district court erred in affirming BLM's action by misunderstanding a critical fact related to public participation and by misapplying the law.
Our review is de novo of the administrative proceeding, right?
That is correct.
As if the district court had not spoken.
That's correct, yes. And I would like to first quickly address standing. The appellants did establish their standing below, and we should have reiterated in our briefs to this court, but each of the NRDC appellants and TRCP did submit affidavits.
What I'm going to suggest, you file supplemental, which I have not seen yet. If we're not satisfied, we'll ask you for further briefing on it, but likely you're satisfying it, so.
Okay.
Go ahead and skip over it, and you're a repeat player, so remember next time to put your standing.
Okay, yes.
There.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Is that agreeable with everybody? Okay, good.
So turning to the issue of public participation under NEPA, here at the heart of this issue is a factual misunderstanding at how the district court applied NEPA and FLPMA, well, here was NEPA, to the facts. And the district court incorrectly concluded that appellants, and I quote, did have the opportunity to comment on the EAs for the projects. And the record simply establishes otherwise. What happened here was there was an environmental impact statement done for the project and the record of decision approved in May 2007. There was public comment there. But BLM chose to defer a key part of the analysis, the site-specific analysis, to later in the game, to when they approved the drilling permits.
Okay, let me just be clear. I'm not clear from the record. What exactly was posted in connection with the drilling permits?
So early on, there is a requirement under FLPMA to post a notice of the application to drill that was submitted. That does not include even the application permit, and it doesn't include any environmental analysis.
All right, but under this other regulation, they had to publish the name of the operator, the location.
That's correct, but there was no analysis. There was nothing for groups like NRDC or Wyoming Outdoor Council.
So what you're arguing is, in another case, you said it would be enough if you got a copy of the application before it was granted. Here you're asking not just for the application information, but for the preliminary analysis that the agency does, and apparently they have in subsequent cases made this available to the public?
They have in other circumstances. I don't know if it's directly been litigated before, but they do. And we are. I want to be clear, we're not arguing that they always have to provide public participation for EAs. This precedent by this court in the Tomac case is clear. It doesn't always have to happen. But here it was an abuse of discretion not to, precisely because BLM chose to take a huge chunk of the analysis and do it later. And then they shut the public out at that later point. And coming back to the notice, there was one other piece of notice that was provided, but no content, nothing to comment on, was ever provided before the decision was made.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt.
I just wanted to point to the NEPA register, which did provide notice that NEPA analysis was being done, but there was no content to comment on. And in fact, we did have a request into BLM to receive that analysis to comment on, and it wasn't provided.
I didn't find that in your briefs, that point. Can you tell me where that was in the briefs? That's one thing I was looking for, whether you were arguing that you had requested something that they didn't give you. Do you make that point in the brief?
It's
a logical question, right, that whether or not you asked, knowing that there was notice, you know, acknowledging that there was notice, did you ask? Is there a place in the briefs where you address it?
I'm not sure it's in the appellant briefs. I'll have to check this. The argument that the government made was that they didn't have to provide the analysis. We had a standing request, and actually the record became clear after the litigation was filed. And then we did, and that's the point at which I got involved as the attorney representing NRDC bringing in the other groups.
Yeah, that record reference to, I can't remember the name of the man's name, but he requested copies of everything.
Yes, Eric Mulvar.
Is that the request you would rely on in this regard?
For that earlier stage, yes.
But not prior. For the EAs?
The Biodiversity Conservation Alliance, they're located in Wyoming. They're following these cases day in and day out. They were very involved from the very beginning, and they had a standing request for the APDs and relevant environmental analysis. There is, as I recall in the record, and I can give you, and this is in the joint appendix, volume 21, 11,023, where BLM essentially takes the position it's not practical for us to respond to a standing request. You need to follow the NEPA notice and request when it's there. And it didn't happen in this case before the four pods at issue, the Catalina A and B and the Sundog A and B, were approved.
I'm not sure. The chronology of what you just said, I'm not sure I'm following. You say that they had a standing request sort of for everything, and the government...
For any APDs related to this big project, the Atlantic Rim.
Just for APDs, but you're looking for a draft EA, right? Isn't that what you're...
And the draft EA is connected with the APD decisions as opposed to the EIS, which has already happened. So
we just issued some order asking people not to use acronyms, and I'm using them with you, but now you're losing me.
We would all appreciate
I'm sorry.
If counsel would be advertent to that order. Reading any sentence in this brief without looking back at the glossary was a rare gem of an experience.
I tell you, it's my habit too, so I perfectly well understand, but there are a few acronyms here that are not that common.
So we're talking about the drilling
permit. Not necessarily that necessary, but excuse me, go ahead.
The drilling permit.
That's right.
Or the applications for a permit to drill. And in that request, it also included the environmental analysis that would be done, which is an environmental assessment in this case. The permits themselves wouldn't give the groups, the public, any content in terms of the environmental analysis, which is our right to comment on underneath.
No, I know, I understand that. What I'm trying to get at is the government, you said that the government says, look, standing requests are big. We can't respond to sort of a standing request. You have to make a more specific request. Let's pause over that. That doesn't seem that unreasonable, does it? It'd be abuse of discretion to say for the government to say, you can't just say give us everything whenever it happens. You have to be more specific when the event happens to focus our attention.
Correct.
Okay. So here, I think the interveners argue at least that the that there was no request for these. I guess there's four of them. Is that are at issue here?
Four pods, plans
yes.
of development.
Yes. That there wasn't a specific request for those. And what's the answer to that?
The answer I would give is that there's revisionist history going on here, and that at the time, BLM wasn't even keeping its NEPA register up to date. So you couldn't rely on it as an accurate mechanism to know when you were going to request. And so these drilling permits, the applications for permits to drill, attached to it with the environmental assessment simply came out of the blue, and then we were left to respond to them. And in fact, we then needed to...
It's maybe more technical than I understand, but I thought you said before that they did post the notices of the application to drill, and that the register said something about a NEPA analysis. So I take it that means at some point, interested parties, at least the people in Wyoming, would know that there were these four pods, right?
Well, I guess I would take issue with that.
Don't take issue because I'm not asserting anything. I'm just asking.
Okay. Well, let me try to clarify.
Yeah.
Because the chronology... It's important to when the drilling permit notices, the notices of the applications for permits to drill were first filed. That was a few years ago. I think it was back in September 2005. The companies come in. They're there in the office for 30 days, and then. As BLM, it's not like they're immediately processed, and that's actually an issue that the industry has taken with BLM. They sit there for a while. So the public doesn't know that anything's going to happen imminently. The NEPA register is something that is on the web, and we, NRDC and other groups, monitor. But when that is then the notice of the environmental analysis that goes with a drilling permit, before it's going to be approved. And the problem here was that, they weren't keeping that up to date. I should, and if I could have the opportunity, I will go back in the record and see if there is clarity as to whether there was a specific request between that point of time when the NEPA register said it was being done and when it was approved. It was a pretty short period of time, but I would argue that it's not... whether or not that request was made, I don't think that this case should turn on that, because I think there's a more fundamental issue, which is in circumstances when site-specific analysis is deferred, a key part of the analysis is deferred, the public should be given a clear opportunity. They knew who these parties were, who were interested.
You can find that during the other arguments. We'll give you back a couple of minutes. Although we've talked to you past your time, we'll give you back a couple of minutes.
Thank you very much.
Rebuttal,
well,
and you can include that.
Can I ask a question?
Oh, sure.
She's still here.
Sure.
About the air quality.
Yes.
Your argument here is that the agency had acknowledged that this, I'm not sure how you pronounce it, Sheffy modeling was outdated and inaccurate. And the agency says, well, it was a conservative estimate and therefore it's enough. What's your response on that?
There's a key distinction there, which is it was actually, the author's model himself said, and that is in the record.
I know it's there. Read it.
And I'll find that site in a second. But the key distinction is that he said it was the wrong tool for the task at hand, because the Sheffield model looked at plumes of pollution, which the ozone issue, which was becoming a very big problem in Wyoming, is not about plumes, it's about the dispersion. So it was the wrong tool for the task at hand.
Well, the agency's response, as I understand it, is that because the Schleffi model was conservative, that was an overestimation of possible ozone, and therefore it could still rely on this method, even though it acknowledged there were better methods out there.
But well, I think the critical distinction is that the way that it's not a question of whether it was conservative or not, it was simply the wrong tool, so it wasn't looking at the right, it wasn't useful in looking at this problem. It wasn't useful at all.
I don't want to get too much into the weeds here, but as I picture it, you're measuring a plume and the concentration within the plume. That's what the model is going to measure.
Right. That's what the Schleffi model was intended
for. That's right. And so one argument could be from a science, and I don't know, this may be counterintuitive, is the fact that the density is so much greater in the plume than it would be in the dispersed modeling, that if you have a conservative estimate based on the plume, therefore you've probably overestimated what a model that measures the dispersal. What I was trying to find was some explanation along those lines, and that's what, I mean, I'll ask the government, too. That's what I wanted to find. I understand you have the words in the record,
right.
And the agency has acknowledged that this model is obsolete. But they have this conclusory language about, because it's a conservative projection, therefore we can rely on it.
And I think what's important is the nature of the problem that's being addressed here, which is the pollution coming from numerous thousands of oil and gas wells, so the drilling rigs, the trucks going back and forth. And this tool was not used to address that kind of problem. It wasn't until relatively recently there wasn't even a recognition that you would get potential ozone non-attainment from oil and gas drilling.
The Schleffi issue raises another question. I know we're keeping way past the time, but we do that habitually.
Yeah.
Suppose they're halfway into a study and a better test comes along. Do they have to go back and start over every time?
No, and that's a critical distinction, because what this case is about is not when is enough enough,
yeah.
But there was a clear point, and it was in September 2006, where the agency made a determination that this Sheffield model isn't up to the task at hand. And so the only question was a question of timing and this one-time transition. We've got a lot of projects in the pipeline, what do we do about mm-hmm. this EIS?
And that's really what I'm asking you.
And so we
say it's an abuse of discretion to not go back and do over what they've been using Schleffi for.
Well, I think so, and I think the flow chart that the agency itself did is clear, because it has a green part and a red part, and this is it in the joint deferred appendix at 7726. And
you know what volume that is?
Yes, it's volume 15.
Always the volumes I bring are not the ones I need.
And we reprinted, actually, this flowchart on page 18 of our reply brief, because it shows that the point at which it was 2006. The rod didn't come out until May 2007. And there were actually other projects at the same time in the pipeline that BLM did make the switch, and they didn't offer any explanation why they didn't do it in this case. And
I thought you had two issues, too. One was that, but then
yes.
There was also the site-specific.
Right, and so that would be the second point that I would make. Regardless, we think the Schleffi model was inappropriate for the EIS. Regardless, there was a second subsequent decision that was initiated after that, that they clearly should have updated the analysis.
Well, what does this chart show, just so I know what
Right. And there is a cleaner example right. in the record. But what it shows is it starts at the bottom where there's the smiley face.
Right.
And that's where the Sheffield method was okay. And at the top, there's the do not use Sheffield. And on that, they have the different projects clearly placed. And so I would argue that not only was it inappropriate under their own determination to use Sheffield for the EIS, but certainly for the drilling permits.
Thank you, Counsel. Thank you. We'll hear from the other appellant, Counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Tom Wilmoth. I'm here on behalf of the appellant, Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership. I apologize in advance for the alphabet soup in this case. We'll try to stay away from that. I understand that the court did have some questions initially about our standing.
If it's agreeable to my colleagues, we'll just wait and examine the supplementary filing.
That's fine.
And if that, which it likely will, appears adequate, then we will be fine. If it doesn't, then we can ask for additional briefing.
Let me give you a heads up here. I have looked at the supplemental filings. And in the district court, you had two affidavits.
Well, just to be clear, Your Honors, our Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership's affidavits are actually already in the joint deferred appendix, and so the supplemental filing pertained to the Natural Resources
Defense Council. You're correct.
Council.
Okay.
So,
sorry.
And
Jay,
I can provide you
volume.
The citations if you care.
Well, give us citations then if you're
certainly.
Not.
And these are in the first volume. There are two affidavits from Dr. Sparrow at 43 and 556.
In volume one.
Correct. And there are also two affidavits from Steve Belinda at 38 and 648.
Okay, now I've read those, and Mr. Belinda says he's hunted in the project area and he continues to hunt in the project area. Mr. Sparrow says I have hunted sage grouse in the project area. If you compare that to the Molvar and State's affidavits, they don't say what the Supreme Court seems to be focusing on in Summers, is that there's some intention to return, and not just, sort of a casual, maybe I'll go back.
Sure, and really the root of all of that, of course, is the Lujan case, and mm-hmm. at the end of the day, this is not like the Lujan case. These are folks who live in the area, who work in the area, who hunt this area presently. This is not a situation where they once were in Sri Lanka.
That's what we want you to establish for us.
Yes, and I believe that's what the affidavits state, especially Mr. Belinda's. Dr. Sparrow's affidavit, one of them, of course, was at issue in the district court because it went beyond just standing and it spoke to issues that we thought were material that were not reviewed by BLM in its process.
In any event, we only need one plaintiff withstanding.
That's yes. Enough. And I should say also the IBLA decision, the Interior Board of Land Appeals decision, finding that TRCP had standing also is in the Joint Deferred Appendix at 3535. I believe that's volume two.
Whose decision is that?
The Interior Board of Land Appeals. Before this suit was filed, the
Their decision has nothing to do with our decision on standing.
I understand that, Judge.
Yeah. We have all sorts of situations where people can appear before administrative tribunals who do not have standing for Article 3.
And the only reason I discuss it is there are affidavits included in that process also, and they are in the record. So I think Judge Garland, Mr. Belinda's affidavit in particular, establishes the present use of these areas, and Dr. Sparrow's affidavit does speak to continued intent. There are really three substantive points that I'd like to make, and I realize I have very limited time, but to be clear, our principal issue is this. BLM may not go forward and industrialize an area that's seven times larger than the District of Columbia, consistent with the Federal Land Management Policy Act mandate to maintain multiple use and sustained yield on the public land.
That sounds more like a conclusion than an argument. I think what we're being asked to say is, can they do that?
That is correct. And the appellant's position is that is not possible. And the reason that they can't do that is because the Federal Land Policy and Management Act explicitly requires that the federal public lands be managed for multiple use and sustained yield. And this area has been dedicated to a single use, coal bed methane development. There's really no question about this. There's no dispute about this. This term, industrialization, is not a TRCP appellant's characterization. This is BLM's characterization of the ultimate conclusion of the environmental impact statement. We don't think that's consistent with the multiple-use sustained yield mandates in FLIPMA. If you look at the structure of FLIPMA, it is clear that the district court erred in its conclusion that FLIPMA and the multiple-use mandate applies only at the resource management planning level. That's not how the statute is set up, and for that reason, the district court erred. Secondly,
did the agency take that position?
Your Honor, candidly, I'm not sure what the agency's position is in this regard. There's some statements about in the appellee's brief about what the district court believed, but
I'm focusing on the agency because when you read the final EIS as well as the record of decision, I mean, there is a lot of discussion of these various interests and how are they to be balanced.
That is correct, and therefore the real question is, were they balanced?
Well, I mean, I thought your argument was that the agency just sort of ignored these mandates and has industrialized the entire area.
Our argument,
at least when you read the words that the agency has written, there's a balancing going on. In other words, they didn't just turn it over to the drillers and say, go to it.
Well, and that is the key question. When you read the words on the page, is the conclusion supported by the evidence in the record? And the answer to that question is absolutely not. And that is the essence of arbitrary and capricious decision making. If you look fundamentally at how this multiple use and sustained yield management mandate is going to be achieved, the best example of this is the Greater Sage-Grouse Management Program. They essentially adopt a series of measures that the scientific community has uniformly suggested are completely unhelpful and will not preserve sage-grouse in the area. If there was any debate about this, any question at all, we submitted a supplemental authority from the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service speaking to the sage-grouse's legal status under the Endangered Species Act.
It's not endangered.
The Fish and Wildlife Service actually found that the listing as an endangered species was warranted but precluded by other priorities. The most important thing,
though, listed as endangered.
That is correct. The most important thing about that supplemental authority, however, is the conclusion therein that there is no science to support the mitigation measures that the BLM has employed in the Atlantic Rim project. If there was no support in 2010, there was no support in 27. In 2007, there was no support in 2006. The conclusions, therefore, the words on the page, if you will, Judge Rogers, are not supported by the evidence in the record. I see that I'm out of time. I'm happy to address other questions.
We talked you past your time, as is our usual habit or frequent habit. So do you need a minute to wind up in, and then you can have a couple back for rebuttal?
I appreciate that. I do just have one last issue, and that is to say all of this should have been avoided. This issue never should have been before the court. This litigation shouldn't have been filed because it's our position that 40 CFR 1506 should have prohibited BLM, and in fact did prohibit BLM, from proceeding to finalize the project because there was an ongoing NEPA process, National Environmental Policy Act process, related to the resource management plan that is the umbrella document that says how all the lands within that planning area will be affected.
Now, what you were referring to a moment ago about the scientific authority on the sage grouse, was that before the agency?
The fundamental information that was analyzed by the Fish and Wildlife Service, about which they concluded there was no support for what BLM has done, much of that information was, in fact, in front of the agency, either submitted by appellants.
Using as your hammer there, the conclusion from FWS was not before the agency, was it?
Well, it postdated the decision.
Right.
So the answer
is postdated the decision, so the answer is no, that's not record evidence. So saying that the words on the page are inconsistent with that is not generally going to get you very far, is it?
Well, I think that the real issue is none of the material in the record supports the ultimate decision. Yeah. And to the extent
that might be a better issue, but to come argue that stuff that happened after the date of decision is inconsistent with the decision is not consistent with the way we normally look at administrative review.
I understand. The only reason we brought that up was because it did speak to the material that was in front of
all
the
right,
agency.
But the material that was before the agency from the Fish and Wildlife Service, I'll put it as a hypothetical. Suppose the Fish and Wildlife Service said if you allow one drill this will cause the extinction of the sage grouse. And the agency says we're going to take that into account, but there are other interests we are to balance. And they say we decide that these other interests are more important, and we'll take some steps that may in fact help the sage grouse come back and reestablish a habitat. Are you saying that's prohibited under the Federal Land Policy Management Act?
What I'm saying is if the BLM makes a decision in the face of evidence from other expert agencies that will completely devote a single area to a single use, that is inconsistent with multiple use and sustained yield mandates. Now, your hypothetical with a single well, obviously, as the cases have held,
My hypothetical 2,000 wells. I'm just trying to get the point of where the agency has information from, in this case, the Fish and Wildlife Service, that this will do great harm to a potentially endangered species. And the agency says, we acknowledge that, but there are other interests involved, and we think those other interests outweigh the interest in the sage grouse. Is it your position that the statute prohibits the agency from making that type of balancing?
Well, I think what you're really getting at is what is the size of the relevant parcel? What is the parcel we're talking about to which multiple use and sustained yield applies?
I don't think
I'm just trying to understand what your position on the statute is, because when I read the definitions of these mandates, I mean, they're not easy to apply, and you acknowledge that there's a difficult balancing here. And I understand your point about the mitigation program is virtually worthless. But I didn't find that you cited any authority for the point that the agency would be prohibited, where another agency pointed out a devastating problem.
And certainly it's incumbent on the Bureau of Land Management to manage these lands and adhere to the multiple use and sustained yield mandates. They certainly need to take into account the information provided by expert agencies. And when the expert agencies like the Fish and Wildlife Service reject uniformly the program that they intend to implement, BLM intends to implement, to achieve its multiple use and sustained yield mandates, then if the BLM just patently ignores that, then that's an arbitrary and capricious decision.
My hypothetical is they didn't ignore it.
Right.
But they just balanced it out of their equation.
And in your hypothetical, that might be acceptable, but in this case, it was ignored. The appellees will tell you, well, there's lots of material in the record that says we didn't ignore it, but there's not a single citation in their brief to that material. And I don't think they can muster a citation to that effect. I don't think, in other words, that the Bureau of Land Management considered the information provided by the Fish and Wildlife Service and said, for these other reasons, we disagree that this is going to be a problem with sage grouse.
No, they didn't say that, but they said that they were adopting alternative D and they were taking some steps. Let me just say, the way I read your point is that this massive area, because of all the drilling, the roads, the trucks, I mean, nobody's going to want to go hunt there because the animals won't be there, and that's what you mean by industrialization.
Right.
If you read the agency's view, well, it's only 13,000 acres that's really going to be disturbed, and only 6,000 at a time. So it's not this, quote, industrialization picture that you see.
And again, just to be clear, that's not our term. That's not the appellant's term.
I understand it's not your term. I'm using it.
And I think that is simply a way for the appellees to minimize the ultimate conclusion. In other words, all of this information was digested, all of this information was analyzed, and when it came down to a single characterization of what was going to happen to this huge area, the word used was industrialization or industrialize, and now we hear kind of a numbers game about, well, the direct impacts are only 6,700 and the indirect impacts are only this many acres. And, you know, frankly, this case has never been about the direct impacts. It's always been about the indirect impacts, and those impacts result in the industrialization.
Okay, thank you, counsel. We'll give you back a couple of minutes for rebuttal. We'll hear from the respondent.
Good May it please the court. My name is Robert Oakley. I'm here on behalf of the appellees. I'm an attorney from the Department of Justice. I'd like to go briefly to the question of standing, at least with reference to TRCP.
Okay.
Judge Garland, you made a point that normally, which is the normal rule, that if you establish standing for one party, you establish it for everybody. I don't think that rule applies here, and this is why. There's a joint brief filed here, and if you go through that joint brief, with the exception of one argument, and that's the argument on the public notice requirement for the environmental assessments done from the for the pods, they made separate arguments. They did not join in each other's arguments, except for that one. And I think the law is that you have to establish standing on a claim-by-claim basis. And where you have parties making separate claims, the fact that one of them, and I think NRDC probably has established standing, doesn't get the other one out of hot water if where that other party is making independent and distinct
what
claims.
What claims would you say then are subject to the standing challenge?
All the FLIPMA claims. NRDC makes no FLIPMA claims.
Those drop out?
They would drop out.
And the wind, because nobody wind, raised it. That's a different issue, isn't it?
The wind would drop out.
Wind was not raised below anyway,
yeah.
Right?
Well, I believe, some evidence was excluded, but they argued cumulative impacts on wind should have been addressed, they being TRC.
Can you point out where in the brief they say that they don't join each other's arguments?
Well, if you just look at the way the brief is written, Your Honor.
That's a different question. I mean, there has to be something indicating that this is not a joint brief when it says it's a joint brief.
They always oppose consolidation, and they asked to file separate briefs. And
they didn't. They have one brief here.
They did have one brief, but if you go through the arguments, they are made either by TRCP or by NRDC. They, for example, if you look at page 26 of the blue brief, section 2A, towards the bottom of the page, it says TRCP's arguments below was straightforward. This is
that doesn't mean that NRDC isn't adopting their arguments.
They certainly have. They've never done so.
Here's the brief filed in a joint brief. The top part two doesn't say this is TRCP's argument.
I believe it does, because if you look every page, every paragraph, I think you're going to have to
look at
it. Look
at page 24. It says, in addition to the former appellant, TRCP contends. The bottom paragraph on page.
Yes, I mean, if you go through, summary argument on page 24, appellant TRCP contends, and that's the FLIPMA part of the case.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see what you mean.
Yeah. So I think you're going to have to, it's just not as easy to go back. I understand that that is a general rule. I just don't think that general rule applies here. And then I would also then caution that you need to look at the TRCBF declarations, because they're just pretty much, I went to this area which they like to talk about being seven times the District of Columbia in terms of acreage, and I did some hunting there. But unlike the NRDC affidavits, they don't say that they've had any impact yet or will in the future from these drilling activities. That is, they don't say, I've been there and I've looked at a map, I see that wells are planned for this area, et cetera. But in any event, I would like to get to the merits of the issues, and I'll start with the NRDC, and it's interesting that they start with a fairly small part of the case, and that is not the EIS in general, but the subsequent approval plans of development for the Sundog and Catalina projects. Now first, and this is pointed out at, I believe, the lessee's brief at page 28, footnote 16, the blanket request was made after the first A and B plans of development, or PODs, had been approved. That was in September of 2007. This is page 28, footnote 16. And that's citing to the Molvar Declaration. Now, in response to specific request, BLM did give draft EAs for the subsequent Sundog plans of development, C, D, and E, to NRDC, and got comments from one of the groups that make up NRDC, Biodiversity Conservation Alliance, and they responded to them. So in addition to that, of course, there was the posting in the Wyoming Reading Room of the applications for permits to drill. And as far as the web register being out of date, it's our belief that we demonstrated below that it was not. so that anybody had gone on the website, and these, I do not have volume numbers, but counsel for the lessees has given me page numbers for the notices of the EAs that were posted, and those can be found at Joint Deferred Appendix 10937, 10967, and then 11082, and then I believe there's a supplemental Joint Deferred Appendix at 136. So I would direct the court there so that this, there was additional notice.
So could provided. I just be clear, the agency has a regulation, or there is a regulation saying that they will post the name, the location that's proposed for the drilling. Is that the limit of the legal obligation?
It may be, but in this case, I think the web notice improves it. It's certainly the limit of what the agency specifically committed itself to do, but were this court to find that that was insufficient, you could look to what the agency has voluntarily done.
That was going to be my next question. Has the agency now voluntarily said it will make these environmental assessments available prior to approving the drilling permits?
Well, and they'll certainly provide notice of them, and I believe they're now, if you had it, certainly when I was working on the brief, they were available on the court's, I'm sorry, on the agency's website for this project.
And we're talking about the site-specific environmental assessment.
That's right. That's where I got my copies.
Okay. So far as we know, then, that's the standard operating procedure of the agency.
It'd be the SOP.
That's my understanding, Your Honor, and I can confirm that if you by a subsequent letter, if you'd like.
I suppose if it's not, we'd like to know.
All right. Well, then, I'll get you a letter one way or the other, Your Honor. Turning next to the question of the Sheffy letter, and I direct the court's attention because I think the contents of that letter are considerably overstated. It's found in volume 20 of the Joint Deferred Appendix at page 9881, and Mr. Sheffy never talks about it being a bad tool. He just says he is critical of it.
He says it's inadequate to the task.
He says, yes, but he says it is inadequate. He says it was never approved by EPA.
EPA rejected and BLM acknowledges it's obsolete. I mean, the only question in my mind, based on the record here, is the one that the chief judge asked you about.
Well, when we say obsolete, I think we have to draw a distinction. Did BLM recognize that better tests have come along and that could more accurately project the possibility of ozone formation? The answer is yes. But does that mean that the Sheffy test is no better than flipping a coin? No, he doesn't
say. But where does the agency say that while the Sheffy model looks at, and this is my way of putting it, A, namely that plume, and the improved tests, which the BLM acknowledges exist out there, measure B, which is the dispersal, that the B measurement would be comparable to the conservative Schleff measurement. That's what I don't see here. In other words, everybody cites this case where I wrote on behalf of the court, but in that case, the agency had said, look, even if we use these new models, the results would be virtually the same. That's what I don't see here.
What you see is that, and I think you also need to look at another landfill where they, which was not landfill, sorry, development where that was going on at the same time, the Jonah infill project, which is addressed in the IBLA decision, Wyoming Outdoor Council. They looked to their part, the agency BLM looked to its partners, the EPA and the Wyoming DEQ.
Which project is this?
Well, in both.
Oh, but you said in this comparable
project. All right, I'll stick with the comparable and not confuse you by jumping back and forth. Let me stick with Jonah infill. In that case, actually, EPA.
Can I just understand what that word is? The Jonfill?
I'm sorry, Jonah, like Jonah and the whale.
Right.
Yeah.
Infill.
All right.
And I'm not sure why they call it infill.
That's fine. But
I don't know what you're talking about.
Because it's infill.
Well,
All right, so in that project.
In that project, also using the Sheffy method, and actually that's where the Sheffy letter first shows up.
Right.
EPA Region 8, when consulted about, reconsulted really about Sheffy, it had never raised any objection, says, well, while we might not have picked this, it is an acceptable method. Dr. Sheffy's own paper, which has the Sheffy method in it, he himself describes it in that place as conservative. And that's not simply rebutted at any point.
But what about counsel's argument that what we were talking about here was concern about ozone from many sources, all right, not just a single plume?
Well, Dr. Sheffy's letter being critical of his method doesn't address that issue. I mean, that's
No, but he says it was inadequate then, EPA didn't adopt it, and so if it was inadequate then, it's certainly inadequate now, because since 1988 there's been all of this technological advance on measuring ozone. And I just don't see the connection that says that we'd have virtually the same results. That's what I'm looking for.
The agency doesn't say that we'd have virtually the same results, but the agency does say that if that all the evidence it had, it says two things. One, all the evidence it had was that if the Sheffy method was going to skew, it would skew conservatively. And secondly, and this goes to the Jonah infill case, EPA Region 8 found it acceptable. And in this case, there's no objection from, and now I'm switching back to Atlantic Rim, no objection from EPA, no objection from Wyoming DEQ.
And but these EPA are, had rejected it. I mean, if you understand, they say this is not an adequate model. We're not adopting it as one of the models we recommend.
For our purposes, that is correct.
Yeah. Well, we're measuring ozone for purposes of the National Air Quality Standards.
Yes.
That's EPA.
That's EPA.
So it's not there in the record, and I'm not going to find it, is what you're telling me.
What you'll simply find is that it's conservative. Dr. Sheffy said it was conservative when he was creating it. But can we say that the results would be the same?
Or virtually the same.
No, I can't tell you that. No,
and it's not in the record. The agency hasn't told us that. That's what you're telling me.
That's what I'm – yes, I would agree with that characterization.
Thank you.
Could I just ask about that?
Yes.
I thought the point of the Wyoming Outdoor Council decision was that it would – produce more conservative results than the other methods, newer methods. Is that wrong?
Yes.
Well, then.
No, I'm sorry, not wrong.
No, it's right.
No, I'm sorry. The Wyoming outdoor is that if Sheffy has a flaw, it is that it is going to overpredict the likelihood of formation of ozone. That's the point of the Wyoming Outdoor Council decision.
Right.
That is in our record, but it's in the Wyoming Outdoor Council.
Yes.
Right. So that's my only point is I understand that, and that's what conservative means. So when it measures the plume under this model that's looking at the plume, my point to counsel was, well, that's a very dense area, so it may overestimate the amount of ozone if you project that measurement across the board. But then you have Dr. Sheffy saying, since 1988, there's such much better ways of measuring this. What I don't understand quite is how the agency can say that because there was a plume measurement that's conservative, that's the same as saying if we use the modern model, we'd come out virtually the same, or that the modern model would not be as conservative as Sheffield.
Well, I think you're jumping, with all due respect, Judge Rogers,
yeah.
You're jumping from, I mean, Dr. Sheffy doesn't say anything about plumes in his letter.
But the model is a plume measurement model.
But it uses tables, and yes, but...
I don't think that's disputed.
I'm sorry?
I don't think that's disputed, that it's a plume model.
All right. But he simply says that there are better models now. And the question, the agency doesn't have to have the best model. It just has to have one that's reasonably good enough. And Dr. Sheffy also doesn't say that this is going to result in junk science, junk numbers. So,
does not say that.
He does not say that. I may be dropping my knots, which can get me in a lot of trouble.
I just may not hear as well as some colleagues. Excuse me, go
ahead. Well, I'm battling a cold, so I'm...
Well, when the person, the expert who developed the model says it's inadequate, I mean, that's pretty devastating.
It's not helpful. And I don't care for the smiley or not smiley face, but I don't think that, you never like humor in your administrative records or attempts thereat. But I actually, to be honest, Judge Rogers,
we don't get a lot of it. No.
Well, you're not going to get any from me. But I'm kind of, just to go back to Dr. Sheffy, it's interesting. Obviously, he's in contact with the plaintiffs, and there's nothing wrong with that. I'm not complaining about that. But he could have driven a stake into the air analysis. If he had another paragraph where he said, I've looked at the EIS, I've looked at the way that this is done, and these numbers are just worthless.
But what you would be saying, though, rather than saying it's virtually the same, you would be saying that if we'd used a later method, the numbers would be more favorable to continuing the project rather than less favorable.
That's the basis on which the agency, and also that it had gotten through, it had a method that agencies whose day-to-day business it is to enforce the Clean Air Act had either not objected to or, in the case of the Jonah infill landfill, said was an acceptable method. I think that the agency has met its burden there.
So the rule is that even though there is an inadequate model, if it measures conservatively, the agency may properly rely on it?
As long as it is generating some reasonable numbers.
My question. See, that's my whole point. Is it generating reasonable numbers?
I think you have to conclude that it was, because EPA Region 8 in the Wyoming Outdoor Council IBLA decision surely should have said then, no, these numbers are junk. This is junk science. You know, don't do this. They should have said that in this case. And if you look at their comment letters, they don't raise this issue at all. And I think BLM, while it doesn't have to automatically defer to other agencies, is entitled to rely on agencies whose real force is to enforce the Clean Air Act.
Well, segueing to the other argument then, if the Field and Wildlife Service says this project is going to be devastating to the sage grouse, can BLM just ignore it? There's an agency that's fully objecting. It's the expert. I mean, is there
the agency first is taking steps to mitigate impacts to the sage grouse?
The expert agency says. Those are useless.
They don't like the one quarter mile limitation on activities within a lek, which is a strutting ground for the sage grouse. But the that number had a basis in scientific literature. The agency can pick among the scientific literature and I think it was reasonable to do so. In terms of industrializing, I mean, we've got to remember this area is already generating a great deal, I think, of natural gas from the state of Wyoming. Secondly, as Your Honor, Judge Rogers, as you pointed out, we're not paving over seven times the District of Columbia. It's maximum, I believe, around 16,000 acres total over the history of the project. And at one time, though, only 7,600 acres can be disturbed. Now, I would agree that there would be some impacts of that disturbance beyond the property or the exact line of the pads for the wells, but it's going to get less as you go further and further away. And these uses, if you look at the multiple uses for which the agency is charged with managing these lands, they're clearly incompatible. And you have the suggestion by TRCP is, well, up to one square mile, okay. They have no case support for this, but they say up to one square mile. They pull that out of thin air and say you can do pretty much what you want, but that's it. And that's just going to put a stranglehold, I think, on BLM, especially for energy development, that Congress never intended to put If it wanted to impose this kind of restrictions in FLIPMA, it could have put them in FLIPMA. But instead, it creates what the Supreme Court has called this very complex task of managing for it really inconsistent uses. And I think the agency did take this into consideration for both the sage grass, for the mule deer, the business about the subsequent listing. I think it is subsequent. I think I would refer the court to our response to the 28J letter submitted by TRCP and say we point out that quite a few of those people's work did not exist at the time. And the agency continues to do what it can. In fact, it comes back both to that and your air modeling question. It's important to remember that it's not like we've just given a pass to the drillers and said goodbye. We are continuing to monitor, measure ozone levels in the area. We are continuing to assess through the annual meetings, through the other information that
the problem is, and I mean, the Ninth Circuit has pointed this out, that you can't say we're going to go ahead and do something, and then if it turns out, you know, we violated all these standards, we'll chat about it with the state and we'll chat about it with the operators. And that's what this says. And it doesn't say anything about, well, if we use this particular mitigating measure, it would in fact mitigate the problem. So, I mean, this is just a hope that, you know, the federal government and the state government and the operator will all reach agreement.
I don't believe BLM can allow this facility, I'm not facility, but the project area to become a non, I mean, to consistently violate the NAA.
The words here just say we will consult. It doesn't say we'll do anything.
No, but if there's a violation, then there's a problem.
And they have to bring another lawsuit? I mean, that's
Very possibly could. I mean, then you have a violation under the Clean Air Act.
Well, the only point is that at least one circuit has suggested you can't say you have a mitigation program when, in fact, there are no teeth to the mitigation program, and that the court should just ignore it because it's meaningless.
Well, I just would refer the court to some of the discussion in Judge Leon's opinion below, where he lays out some of the mitigation measures we did specifically identify, and that this adaptive management process is very commonly used because you just don't know. You can't know in the future what all the problems are going to be. And the adaptive management processes are being carried out at the facility. Mm-hmm. If the court has any other questions,
Being none, thank you, counsel. We'll give Ms. Buccino back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple quick points. On the air quality, the Jonah infill project, and that's infilling within development that was already there, was before this all happened. And actually, that's clearly shown on the flow chart in the joint appendix at 727. You have a rest in peace for the Jonah infill. And what's key is that it was in September 2006. Not only BLM, but EPA, they were all in the room together, and it's memorialized in the record in the memo that they all agree, September 2006, this is an inappropriate tool to use for air quality analysis. And that's volume 15 at 7725. So the only question is one of timing, and we believe it was both inappropriate to use the Sheffield method for the EIS and certainly for the drilling permit approvals. And then second, I'd just like to quickly touch on the cumulative impact question, which I had not gotten to initially. And just, it is de novo review here, but I want to highlight what I think was a significant shift in the law that the district court made by inserting the requirement for some kind of certainty into the meaning of reasonably foreseeable, which is inconsistent with both the CLEPI decision by the Supreme Court.
Is this rebutting something he said?
Up here
for purposes
I guess you're right.
Of rebuttal. I don't want to have to give the government a second round.
Okay. Fair enough. But the cumulative impact issue is addressed in our brief.
Okay.
So I'll leave it at that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we'll give a couple of minutes back to Mr. Wilmoth.
Thank you very much, Your Honor. I'll just touch on one issue that involves an exchange between Judge Rogers and counsel for the appellees. You know, this issue of the adaptive management plan and the need for the adaptive management plan, and well, there's so much uncertainty as to how this project is going to impact species, and that's why we had to have this kind of vague and amorphous plan with lots of flexibility. I would be more sympathetic to that if the premise of that were true. The fact of the matter is there is an awful lot of certainty about how this project might impact certain species, and there's a lot of scientific literature that explains those impacts. What you're hearing is, it's okay because we know those impacts are going to occur, but we're going to mitigate in the future. And I think, Judge Rogers, as you picked up correctly, there's really no statement as to what exactly will be done. And if there's anything in this entire record that solidifies that point more clearly, it's the errata sheet that was attached to the record of decision approving the project. This is part of the joint deferred appendix. It's at 10789. I apologize, I don't have the number.
Did you raise this point in your brief about the errata sheet?
Well, this whole point of
no, but
it's
about
impossible
the sheet,
to...
We have to get...
I believe we cited this.
Go ahead. If you did, then it's fine.
I believe we cited this principle of the shifting...
Did you mention this errata sheet?
I can't remember if we have a citation to this page in the joint deferred appendix.
Right, you made a point about shifting.
Yes, absolutely. The point of this is very simple. This is the sheet that talks about best management practices. Best management practices are what you do on the ground to mitigate impacts. In the EIS, the best management practices, the appendix was entitled Required Best Management Practices. The errata sheet strikes the word required. It goes through and it strikes various points of this, and it explains essentially that these BMPs will be applied, quote, as appropriate. That's the interlineation. This is the problem that we have. When you go through this EIS and you look at the impact analyses on hunting in particular, on wildlife, it's nearly impossible to tell what's going to be done. There is no if-this-then scenario that would allow one to say, okay, well, if this occurred, then they would do this, and that would help mitigate. Very simply,
you'll
Judge Rogers, there's no...
There's
no sense of the effectiveness of this mitigation. I thank you very much for your time.
Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted. Give us recess.